People in Yemen are hungry. The UN is asking wealthy nations to pledge money to help prevent a famine. The donor goal fell woefully short.
It's going to be impossible with such limited resources to prevent a large-scale famine.
One hospital in Yemen is seeing lots of severely malnourished kids. Also today, a major court ruling for the LGBTQ community in Poland is cause for celebration.
This was something that we were all waiting for so long.
And the Cherokee Nation is revising its constitution and officially redefining what it means to be a citizen. Some say it's about time.
The Cherokee Nation has long been adopting other peoples to help the nation grow and stay strong.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us. We begin today's program looking at Brazil and the pandemic. The news is not good. Daily mortality from COVID-19 has reached an all-time high there. On Tuesday, Brazil's health ministry documented more than 1,600 deaths. On top of that bad news, a new variant has also emerged in Brazil that appears to be more contagious. Journalist Michael Fox is based in Florianópolis. Let's start with where you are there in Florianópolis, Michael, in the state of Santa Catarina. What is the situation like in terms of cases, access, and testing and vaccines?
Well, it's not good. Basically, we're at the worst off that we've seen so far. We have 251 people on a wait list to be transferred into ICU units. Some of those people are going to be transferred into other states, particularly the west side of the state. That's where health systems aren't as robust. That's been hit really, really hard, particularly those health systems. And it's a similar situation, not just in Santa Catarina, but also in Rio Grande do Sul, just to our south, and Paraná, which is just to our north. And many people are looking at this as coming from people in the middle of summer, you know, over the holidays, people were out at the beach. Very few people were actually using masks. We saw the same thing during Carnival. Carnival was actually canceled, but people were still out in the streets. A lot of people had those days off. And so it's hard to see a light at the end of the tunnel.
So moving to the national level, is there a sense among Brazilians that the country is in a real crisis at the moment?
Marco, this is a really hard, complicated question because in one sense, absolutely, you know, Brazil across the country is seeing this. You have a situation where the ICU occupancy in 8 states is above 90%, 17 states ICUs are above 80%. And in fact, Sao Paulo said that their health system is looking like it's headed toward collapse within the next 2 weeks. Obviously, people are nervous, but at the same time, Brazil has been battling with this whole question of lockdowns. It's been battling with the rising cases, the falling cases, the rising cases again. So a lot of people just want to get on with their lives. And that's why we're seeing many people out in the streets without their masks on. They're just going about their lives. But of course, that's creating this space for more contagious growth of the virus.
There's some new unsettling research about a new variant of the virus that has emerged in Manaus. That's deep in the Amazon. Tell us about that.
So this variant, according to the research, it's looking like it could have as much as 10 times the viral load of a normal coronavirus case. It could be as much as 2 times as contagious. And many of the people that could be contracting this new variant, they could be reinfections. As of 100 people in Manaus, which is where this was born in the Amazon, roughly 25 to 60% of those cases in Manaus could have been reinfections. And that's why people are really concerned, because they're looking at what this could mean for the rest of the Brazil as this variant is spreading throughout the rest of the country, particularly those cases where people might be getting vaccinated, people might have already had coronavirus, because it is more infectious, more contagious, and it might be able to get around the defenses that we're building right now.
What about the vaccine rollout in Brazil? Because historically, the country has had one of the strongest vaccination programs on the planet. Is that being put to use in this current effort?
It is not being put to use. And that's one of the things that's most concerning with people around the country. In fact, former President Lula tweeted out just a few days ago that during the H1N1 virus, roughly a decade ago, Brazil was able to vaccinate 80 million people in just 3 months. And at this point, they've only vaccinated so far 7 million. President Bolsonaro says he's bought more vaccines, says they're coming, but it's been really, really slow.
Famously, Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro downplayed the COVID pandemic. Is he continuing with that?
Marco, it just continues. It's the exact same. In fact, you know, it reminds me of where we were back in April and May when he was railing against governors for instituting lockdowns, and that's the exact same thing that we're seeing right now. That's part of the problem, is him spreading this misinformation. It creates this sense of anti-vaccine. In fact, we saw a spike in here. More people came out against the vaccines at the end of last year. Instead of saying, I want to be vaccinated, people were actually nervous about it because they don't know what to believe. Bolsonaro, several months ago, he said that you don't know what's going to happen. You might turn into a crocodile. Women might grow beards. We just don't know what's going to happen. And so it's that type of talk that's creating uncertainty in Brazil. In fact, I have family members, elderly family members, that are concerned and they don't know if they want to take the vaccine or not. And so it's that doubt that's been sowed in Brazil that's adding to this problem.
Extraordinary. Journalist Michael Fox speaking with us from Florianópolis, Brazil. Thank you very much, Michael.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This week, the United Nations brought together the world's richest nations, online of course, to raise funds to avert a famine in Yemen. The goal was about $4 billion. The world's richest nations pledged less than half that, $1.7 billion. The UN's Mark Lowcock stated the obvious.
This does not solve the problem. We're disappointed in the outcome. It's going to be impossible with such limited resources to prevent a large-scale famine.
And widespread hunger in Yemen is growing worse. One indicator, the rising number of Yemeni children being treated for malnutrition. Muriel Boursier is the head of mission there for MSF, Doctors Without Borders, and joins us now from her office in Sana'a. Muriel, how do we know that Yemen's malnutrition problem is growing worse? What is the data you're looking at?
Well, so for us as Doctors Without Borders, we humbly don't really pretend to have a global overview of what is happening all over the country, because what we witness is only reflecting our activities in specific locations. In Abs, for example, in northern Yemen, we have seen quite high number of admissions as compared to the same period last year. We've seen an increase of 41% of the cases of children under 5 being admitted. So this means that there is an increase, at least in this location, of the number of cases of severe malnutrition.
So you're not an MD, but I'm wondering still if you can give us a non-technical description of malnutrition in a child who comes in for treatment. Like physically, what kind of state are many of them in?
Well, most of the children are, of course, very much underweight for the age. They are very skinny, which result usually in an appearance with a head being bigger, for example, than the rest of the body.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's a bit sad to see that these children most of the time are not really smiling or very much playing, because they are many times sick on the top of their malnutrition, because usually malnutrition is hosting as well comorbidities, how we call it.
Yeah.
So they many times have also diarrhea or respiratory tract infections and other types of complications that aggravate their health status and make them weaker as well. So they are usually weak.
Yeah, that listless quality. I've seen that before. So we heard from the UN's Mark Lowcock a moment ago. The UN donor conference came up woefully short in funding UN aid programs. How will that cutback in aid affect the work of your organization, Doctors Without Borders?
Well, in MSF, as you may know, we work under private funding mostly, so it's not directly affecting us in our programming, but of course, needs are big in Yemen and we can't respond to these needs on our own. We are a medical organization, but there are also other water and sanitation needs, food security needs, other needs that are not covered by MSF and that are as important as health.
This is not your first rotation in Yemen, Muriel. When did you first serve there and how have things changed since then?
I served there for the first time in 2010.
Yeah, 2010. That was right before the Arab Spring and it's been kind of downhill since then.
Yes.
Why did you come back to work in Yemen and why is this particular country important to you and your work?
Well, I came back because, beyond the images we see in the medias and beyond all that, it's also a country with a lot of beauty. It's also a country where people are extremely resilient and are extremely generous and very strong values. And it's an honor also to work along with the Yemeni people who have such a commitment to help also the other Yemeni people, the most vulnerable ones. So it's not only, of course, that's what we see mostly, a country at war, but it's also a country that that you get very much under your skin after coming there several times.
That is a side of Yemen that we don't hear a lot about, so thank you for noting that. Muriel Boursier, the head of the MSF mission in Yemen, speaking with us from Sana'a about the impact of the war there on Yemeni patients' health. Muriel, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you as well.
Three LGBTQ activists in Poland had been on trial for nearly a year. They were charged with offending religious feelings after hanging up posters of the Virgin Mary with a rainbow halo outside of a church. This week, a verdict. A judge in the city of Płock ruled them not guilty. The queer community in Poland is celebrating the ruling. The World's Bianca Hillier has the latest.
All eyes were on Judge Agnieszka Warhol as she delivered the verdict.
Oskarżone uniewinnia od popełnienia zarzucanego im czynu. Po drugie, koszty postępowania ponosi skarb państwa.
Not guilty. In the courtroom, the now innocent activists broke down in tears. Others began frantically tweeting out the news. Within seconds, it reached the crowd of supporters standing just outside the building. Their triumphant cheers could be heard through the walls as the judge continued her ruling. Karolina Gierdal, a lawyer for a Polish organization called Campaign Against Homophobia, heard the applause from inside the courtroom. She says the celebrations are justified.
This was something that we were all waiting for so long.
Karolina says this week's ruling is significant not only because of the acquittal, but also because of the reasons the judge gave. Judge Warhol ruled that rainbow flags aren't capable of offending religious feelings because...
Because it is genuinely a symbol of equality, of love, of human dignity, and therefore it cannot defame anything. It only has positive values.
Even Karolina, who felt optimistic going into court, was surprised to hear such a striking statement against homophobia from a Polish courtroom. The Catholic priest who originally filed a complaint against the activists was also surprised. He said the rainbow desecration of the Virgin Mary did offend his religious feelings because, quote, those colors are associated with disgusting, reprehensible messages. But Judge Warhol had even more to say.
A jedynie daje do myślenia, że osoby nieheteronormatywne...
The judge ruled that the activists, Elżbieta, Anya, and Joanna, are brave leaders, not criminals. She said they hung up the rainbow posters to protect people from homophobia in the Catholic Church. Karolina says the specific church they were protesting had recently labeled LGBTQ identities as sinful in an Easter art installment.
According to the court, this installment was homophobic. And this is also something that I really didn't expect to hear.
The prosecution didn't expect to hear that either. Kaja Godek founded the conservative group that brought the case, the Life and Family Foundation. After the verdict, she wrote on Facebook that, quote, the justification sounds more like a homo activist publication than a sentence passed on behalf of the Republic. She continued, the blame of the accused is unquestionable. Catholics are the most discriminated against group in society. And the courts of the Republic of Poland should protect them from violence, including by LGBT activists. Lawyer Karolina Gierdal says Poland doesn't have a precedent law, so this week's verdict doesn't necessarily mean other judges will rule the same way.
But the justification was extremely powerful, and I believe this will be a sign to other judges in similar cases, because there are other cases.
As for this case, Karolina knows the fight for LGBTQ rights isn't over. The Life and Family Foundation have already announced their appeal, and Karolina believes the Court of Appeals will take the case to Poland's Supreme Court. That process, she says, could take years. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
An Oscar spotlight on an African director, that's just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Nigeria's economy is in crisis, and kidnapping for ransom has become a booming business. Yesterday, Nigerian officials announced that hundreds of schoolgirls who were abducted last week by armed men have been released. It was the second time this has happened in less than a week, though. Last year, a mass kidnapping of schoolchildren at boarding schools happened at least once every 3 weeks, and ransom payments have been steadily growing. Confidence Makari has been following this. He's a security analyst at SBM Intelligence in Lagos. I asked him what we know about the well-being of the hundreds of girls abducted last Friday and released a few days later.
Well, they are fine. They've been taken to the government house in Zamfara State, and so far they've been good. Although some of the girls who escaped during the attack were injured, the few of them have been taken care of. And the bulk of the girls who have been rescued, of course, all of them, about 379 of them, appear to be in good shape.
You recently published a report on the economics of abductions in Nigeria, showing how it's becoming an increasingly lucrative business. Is it ransoms that ultimately get these children freed?
Well, the Nigerian government would want us to believe that they were released because of negotiations and definitely without any ransom paid. But the reality is not so. In our report, we stated that the Nigerian kidnapping industry between 2011 and 2020, the value of the industry stood at between $18 million and $20 million. But I think events since then, when we released the report in May 2020, has taken a huge turn and grown exponentially to engulf virtually all parts of the country.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like. So previous abductions have been profitable, making more abductions popular. Our listeners will remember in 2014, nearly 300 schoolgirls were abducted by Boko Haram. Hashtag bring back our girls trended all over the globe. As I recall, those girls were in captivity for a while, and it seemed it was a long-term Boko Haram strategy to radicalize those young women. Are you saying these recent kidnappings are totally different and just about cold, hard cash?
Yes. For one, the key difference is that when Boko Haram kidnapped the girls, it was basically due to its ideology, coined from its name, that Western education is a sin, and that women, especially the girl child, has no place or no business learning Western education, especially in classrooms. And so they were the target, and they were easy to kidnap. But for these other terrorists in Nigeria's North Central and Northwestern geopolitical zones, I think it's a bit different. The angle to their strategy and motivation is mostly economic. So their own kidnap is tailored towards getting concessions, financial concessions from both state governments, wherever they operate, and the federal government.
You know, I think of school shootings in the United States, and one of the first things a lot of people suggest is to at least have a police officer assigned to be on duty at a school. Is the government at least doing that?
Well, there is that option on the table, but one thing I would say here is that it is not sustainable. And for the exact reason that the United Nations recommended ratio for policing is that every state should have one police officer to 400 citizens. In Nigeria, it is one police officer to 600 citizens. So Nigeria is a country that is under-policed. There has been a rise in the number of attacks on police officers. So as it stands now, the situation is so bad that even police officers are helpless. And so putting a single police officer to guard a boarding school that is so far away from government control or government presence doesn't really tackle the problem.
Confidence Makari is a security analyst at SBM Intelligence in Lagos. Thank you very much for your time and for explaining this growing, intractable crisis.
Thank you very much for having me.
Cinema in West Africa has caught the eyes of Hollywood. The Academy Awards are not till April, but Oscar committee members will make their decision soon about which films will get nominations. There's already a shortlist, though, and a new movie by Philippe Lacote from the Ivory Coast has made the cut for Best International Feature, one of two African directors on that shortlist. Lacote's film is a story about storytelling in an unexpected place. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi reports.
When French-Ivorian director Philippe Lacote was a child, he remembers traveling to the famous Lamaka prison in the Ivory Coast's largest city, Abidjan.
Lamaka was a familiar place for me.
He would visit every weekend because his mother was being held there as a political prisoner. Lacote remembers observing the inmates with fascination.
I had this strong image of Lamaka. As a director, I work with my emotion. I work with my memory. I work with my feelings.
Those early impressions of Lamaka prison form the basis of his latest feature film, Night of the Kings. It tells the story of a new arrival to the prison. He's a young pickpocketer who is selected as the new Roman, a storyteller who must entertain the inmates at night. It's based on a real tradition at the prison.
My goal was to observe this society of prisoners as a complete society. a society with a government, with a law, with his beliefs.
Rahman is played by a first-time actor, Koneh Bakary. In one early scene, he's been dressed up in nice clothes. Inmates crowd around him in a circle, pressuring him to tell them a story.
Il a choisi un nouveau roman. Quelle histoire roman, Bobo? L'amour prend quelle couleur dans son bébé?
What story will the new roman tell? One inmate asks. Will it be one of hope or sadness? Will it be bitter or sweet? As Rahman begins to tell a story of an outlaw named Zama King, he soon realizes there's more to this prison ritual than meets the eye. He will die if the story ends before dawn. It's a familiar and ancient tale, explained Al-Qut.
I didn't create this story. It's Scheherazade, Arabian Nights. It's the same situation.
It's a classic story of Arabian Nights, he said. Al-Qut also drew from the West African tradition of the griot, who is both a storyteller and a historian of culture.
I wanted to pay a sort of tribute to the griot. And the griot is very important for me because he had to say something about mystical things, about cultural things in Ivory Coast.
Al-Qut said the border between the real and the magical is thin in the griot tradition. In the film, Rahman weaves between ancient mythology and the more recent history of the Ivory Coast electoral violence. In a bid for survival, he extends his story into the night. As Rahman narrates, the inmates accentuate his tale with dancing and singing. Many of them, Al-Qut said, were played by real former prisoners. He said they made the film more realistic.
We use the experience to make it visually, and they help us a lot in small details.
For Al-Qut, this film is also a political statement. Prisons, he says, are rarely associated with creativity or storytelling.
It was very important for me to say that politically, poetry can come from everywhere. Telling stories can come from everywhere, even from prison.
Night of the Kings is in French, but it's already gaining a lot of attention in the United States. Last week, it was released in select theaters and is now streaming online. The final nominees for the Oscars will be announced later this month. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Hi, it's Marco. Here at The World, we ended 2020 strong by raising over $100,000 to support the show and this podcast. Thanks to you and these listeners: Donald Mayer, Elizabeth Schaefer, Robert Fogel, Misha Oyama, Richard Brooks, Hans Lodolf, Dave Godwin, Clarence Owens, Catherine Doty, and Richard Rapoon. Thanks for your support throughout 2020 as we dive headfirst into 2021. In Thailand, some Buddhists are annoyed with people disrespecting the Buddha, like getting a tattoo of him. They want penalties, fines for foreigners, and for the observant who disrespect him.
If those person is a Buddhist, they definitely should go to jail.
Prison. That story's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. As we think about the more than 2.5 million deaths from COVID, the tragedy of the pandemic is undeniable. In the past year, we've also seen some upsides: more time with family, less time commuting. I know a lot of people who are refocusing on what really matters in life. When the world essentially shut down last year, many environmentalists thought we'd see huge reductions in carbon emissions that drive climate change. Fewer cars, trucks, and planes moving around mean fewer greenhouse gases spewed into the atmosphere. Now we have some numbers to back that up. According to a new study published in the journal Nature Climate Change, annual carbon emissions dropped 7% in 2020. To put this into context, we're joined by Corinne Le Carré. She's a lead author of the study and is with the University of East Anglia in the UK. What drove this drop, Corinne? Transport, manufacturing shutdowns? Are you able to parse out how each contributed?
Mostly change in road transport. So the fact that people stayed home and didn't use the car around, that was the biggest drop. And then there was a drop in emissions across the economy, the industry, less power production, less consumption in general. But the road transport was really the biggest part.
It is kind of striking that in a year when it feels like everything came to an abrupt standstill, the emissions drop is only 7%. What is your reaction to that figure? Were you expecting it to be a bigger drop?
I think that's a pretty sizable drop, actually, because when we were on the peak of the lockdown in April, then the drop went almost to 20% compared to the same day last year. But the thing is that nothing has changed around us. So as soon as the lockdown eases, then we go back to what we did before, and then the emissions come back up. So it's not really surprising that overall in a year, then the drop is not that large. And it does mean that we're still emitting a lot of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere.
So you're not surprised that it didn't drop more. What happens then when we do come out of the pandemic? How can this reduction be sustained or even made to be greater?
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be a rebound for sure this year. Now, whether the emissions will already go back to where they were before the pandemic is a little unclear if this will happen straight away or in a few years. But it's pretty sure that unless governments ramp up their actions on climate change, and particularly there's an opportunity now that there's going to be all these investments, if you can put these investments to support electric cars, deploying a renewable energy, then that could lead to sustained decreases, good for health, year on year.
So, Corinne, what is your takeaway after kind of seeing those numbers? Was 2020 a victory for the planet in terms of battling climate change and limiting greenhouse gas emissions?
Yeah, I mean, we can't call it a victory because of the COVID impact, but I think it just wakes us up to the size of the action that we need to put in place to tackle climate change. I think we had progress before the COVID-19 crisis. We had this pandemic. Now we're going to reorganize, rebuild, invest in the new economy of tomorrow. And if we can align these priorities, then we could really make a big difference in tackling climate change. But I fear that this hasn't been really realized or sunk in what we need to do to really make the stimulus package consistent with climate actions.
Yeah, the what to do part, the action. How would you best describe that practically?
Well, everything that we invest in, we have to think about investing in infrastructure that gets us out of fossil fuels. So moving all the car fleet to electric car fleet, deploying renewable energy, isolating the homes so that we don't waste so much energy for heating, that kind of things that they're needed, they create job, they're good for the environment, and most of them also have benefits for health. So all the stimulus package plans that the countries around the world are putting together should really be as clean as possible in trying to make these investments that we need at the right place.
Corinne Le Carré is with the University of East Anglia in the UK and the lead author of a new study on carbon emissions in the journal Nature Climate Change. Corinne, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For Buddhists, the image of Buddha is sacred. It makes perfect sense. After all, Buddha is the founder of Buddhism. Buddhists see him as the enlightened one, a great spiritual teacher. At certain times, the observant will kneel before statues of Buddha. In the West, though, the image of Buddha is sometimes used in far less reverential ways. One woman in Thailand had been seeing examples of this for years, thought it was blasphemous, and decided to do something. From Bangkok, the world's Patrick Nguyen has this story.
Master Achedatwadi is not a monk. She doesn't shave her head. She's more like a Buddhist teacher, an activist, who wears snow-white robes. She claims to have meditated for more than 18,000 hours in her lifetime. And she does seem very chilled out.
People long for something that can put them in peace. We want to have peace in our life. That's why Buddhism become more popular.
And yet there is something that makes Master Achedatwadi, I won't say angry, she doesn't seem to get angry, but it does take away some of her peace. It's people using Buddha's image flagrantly, putting his face on a carpet, a skateboard, things you step on, or even putting his face on a decorative toilet seat cover, which is a thing she found online. She shows me her files where she's documented lots of offenses.
This looks like the Buddha's head in alcohol.
Yes, it is. Put the Buddha head in alcohol. They probably want to feel calm and harmony while they're drinking. This is a hurt our feeling and it's very disrespectful.
Achedatwadi used to be a high-flying businesswoman in the jewelry biz. No white robes, just one of half a billion Buddhists on planet Earth. But about 20 years ago, she was on a trip to Paris, and she heard about this bar called Buddha Bar, where they had this giant Buddha head right in the bar. She went to see it for herself, but
I can't even dare to step inside because my heart is shaking. Then I'm starting to cry. Crying, I feel so sad, and I'm begging for help. I said, please, someone help to stop this.
It kind of changed her life. It's partly why she quit her job and started an organization called Knowing Buddha, which tries to stop people from offending Buddhists. On social media, they put out these guilt-inducing videos, like a Thai grandma seeing a Westerner with a tattoo of Buddha on her foot. Grandma says, why do they do such things to the Buddha? Master Acharatwadi says, it's mostly ignorance. Buddhist traditions, like mindfulness, are more trendy around the world, but they can spread Buddhist chic in a way that's detached from the Asian cultures where Buddhism flourishes. Cultures that say, don't put anything sacred on the floor or on your gross foot, and never get a Buddha tattoo.
The human body is dirty, especially when humans have sex.
What is your feeling towards the person who has the tattoo? Are you angry at them? How do you feel?
I have no anger about them at all, but I just want to educate them, and I want to help to lift up the value of Buddha.
She wonders, why don't people treat Buddha like other religious figures?
Because if anything touch Muhammad or Jesus, they'll be in deep trouble. But if they touch anything about Buddhism, the Buddhists hardly have voice to stop them. So they think that they can do anything they want.
Do you think Buddha himself would be upset at this, or would he just let it go?
Letting go means you're letting go your emotion, not letting go the act. Otherwise, if you're using the theory of letting go in everything, we must not have law and order.
Her organization, Knowing Buddha, does try to impose order. As they see it, volunteers web. If you offend them, they will ask you to stop. If you refuse, even if you're outside Thailand, they might get the local Thai embassy to weigh in. Yes, they do have that kind of influence. A Thai news story from a few years back when Louis Vuitton had an art exhibition in Paris with a giant Buddha head on the ground. Acharatwadi went after them with the Thai embassy's help. And Louis Vuitton apologized and put the Buddha head on a platform, off the floor. She says, overall, they have a 50% success rate. And those who don't comply may be named and shamed.
Please help us stop disrespecting Buddha.
A video from Knowing Buddha's Facebook page, which shows a whole gallery of misbehavior, like tourists in bikinis standing next to Buddha statues. They don't like that. For non-Buddhist travelers in Thailand who upset these activists, for mild offenses, Acharatwadi says a warning should do. But if you won't say sorry, she wants punishment.
Like for the foreigner, we should have some just a fine. But if those person is a Buddhist, they definitely should go to jail.
People will say, going to prison, that's too much. And what would your response be?
Going to the jail is not about punishment. But it's about to give you a time and a space for you to really contemplate what you did wrong.
Master Acharatwadi wants Thailand to imitate other Buddhist-majority countries that enforce blasphemy codes, countries like Myanmar or Sri Lanka, which did deport a woman over a Buddha tattoo on her arm. But Thailand doesn't seem to want to go there to potentially scare off tourists, which are already not coming because of COVID-19. Still, when tourists do come back, they may see signs in the airport in Bangkok from the Knowing Buddha organization, warning them against wearing Buddha t-shirts and getting Buddha tattoos.
The purpose is just to raise awareness to the foreigner, because foreigners are the ones who use the Buddha image wrongly.
Now, I had to ask, what is Master Acharatwadi's advice for someone who already has a Buddha tattoo and wants to visit Thailand?
I will tell them that you should erase it. It will be good for you. But if they're not, then whatever consequence it might come, they have to accept it.
For the World, I'm Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
A quick update now to a story we had on yesterday's show. We told you about Ahmed Kabir Kishore, a Bangladeshi political cartoonist who was near death in a prison in Dhaka. He was arrested 10 months ago for cartoons that criticized his government's handling of the pandemic. He'd posted them on Facebook. Today, Bangladesh's high court granted bail to Kishore because of concerns over his health. Kishore's lawyer told the court that his client had been tortured and has injuries to his ear and right leg. In a statement today, Terry Anderson from Cartoonists Rights Network International, the man we spoke with yesterday, he said, Ahmed Kabir Kishore is not yet safe. I expect him to be released without further harm and demand that his allegations of torture be impartially and independently investigated. Smiling with no teeth. It's a powerful visual. It's also the title of the debut album from Ghanaian-Australian musician Genesis Owusu. Life began for Genesis Owusu in Ghana, born Kofi Owusu Ansah. He moved to Australia with his family when he was two. Since his arrival down under, he's been fighting to fit in, which led to a fight for justice. Genesis told me in Canberra he saw two paths before him.
I could either try and like assimilate a bit more into the culture or kind of diverge and really wear the badge of outcast as like a badge of honor. I decided to choose the latter. And I guess doing that growing up led to me being like somewhat of a contrarian.
So that's really fascinating because you recorded your new album, Smiling With No Teeth, before the lockdowns, before the killing of George Floyd, before Black Lives Matter responded forcefully to his killing. I know critics who've heard your new collection of songs are asking, what did you know before all this? How did you predict this? Are you prophetic? I assume you were just watching the fairly non-diverse world around you in Canberra. But what was obvious to you that led to the songs on this recording?
There are a lot of people who thought I was like predicting something. But in reality, it's much more of like a Groundhog Day situation where I've seen these kinds of things so many times and have experienced racial abuse so many times to the point where it's not a shocking occurrence to me. So the creation of the album wasn't me reacting to the current world events, rather relaying what I had already seen and experienced.
Everybody wants the summer without holding the rain. Everybody wants the feeling without touching the pain. Everybody wants the sweetness without tasting the blend. Everybody wants the help, but they ain't lending a hand. Yes, indeed.
Genesis's music for you more powerful than just a medium for entertainment? Like, how do you see your voice as a catalyst for change?
Music for me started and came full circle as a way of catharsis and therapy for me personally. I didn't start making music to make people dance or entertain people in any way. It was literally just my way of expressing myself. Like I would consider myself an introvert, someone who, you know, I stay in my room a lot. Like I have a close circle of friends. I don't talk too much, and music was really just my way of getting things off my chest.
So was it a response to that outcast world that you found yourself part of in Canberra?
Yeah, exactly. It was my way of saying things that I felt like if I were to say in conversation, people might not really understand. So I put it on an instrumental instead.
So maybe that's not so surprising then that Prince is a big influence. He was also someone who didn't care about angering the music industry or disappointing fans when he stuck close to his artistic integrity. Where do you sit with that? I mean, does art come before pleasing the crowd?
Of course. As much as I love the crowd and I love the people who support me, it has always been a personal, like, passion project, something for me to express myself for my own well-being. Prince has been, like, a huge influence on this album specifically. Just, like, yeah, like you said, like, his totally unrelenting, unforgiving way of operating. You could love it or you could hate it, but he's still going to be Prince. I just try to adopt that same unrelenting energy on everything that I do. What you think you're going to do?
Genesis Owusu, the debut album, is Smiling with No Teeth. He's been speaking with us from Canberra, Australia. Thank you so much. Great to meet you.
Thank you so much, Marco. How you think you're going to do? Please don't pick that pocket. There's a face like yours in this locket, and they won't hesitate to kick me out this shopping mall, cause we're at that target.
In an historic ruling last week in Oklahoma, the Cherokee Nation ended a decades-long debate about citizenship status in their tribe. The phrase "by blood" was removed from the tribe's constitution. As Allison Herrera reports, the news comes as relief for many in the Cherokee Nation, but not everyone is happy about it.
When Marilyn Van heard the news last week, she was stunned.
Well, I was very surprised, you know, to read that.
Van was paying close attention to the decision because she's running for a seat on the Cherokee Nation's Tribal Council. Last month, shortly after she did the routine task of filing her paperwork at the Tribal Nation's election office, her candidacy was challenged by another citizen. Why? Because Van is a Cherokee freedman descendant. Freedmen were formerly enslaved people held by the Cherokee Nation before they were removed to Oklahoma on the Trail of Tears. This other citizen pointed to the word "by blood" in the Constitution, meaning that she didn't qualify.
We've come to the 21st century, and the Cherokee Nation is a tribe that, you know, has long been adopting other peoples into the nation to help the nation grow and stay strong.
Van gained her citizenship in 2006, along with a few thousand other freedmen. Then, in 2007, Cherokee Nation voters approved a constitutional amendment, inserting the controversial language into the tribe's constitution. Thousands of other freedmen waiting to get their citizenship were effectively denied until 2017, when Van and others prevailed against the Tribal Nation in federal court. Cherokee freedmen were allowed citizenship, but the "by blood" language remained on the books.
To the extent that there was any ambiguity before, it makes it extremely clear that, you know, there are only one kind of Cherokee, and that's a Cherokee citizen.
That's Cherokee Nation's Attorney General Sarah Hill. She asked the Supreme Court for a hearing to remove the language last month. She said Cherokees are wrestling with their own history and that this decision recognized the promises made on both sides to honor the treaty they signed in 1866.
And those promises were made directly to the Cherokee freedmen and their descendants. And the nation has an obligation to honor that.
Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr., Cherokee Nation's leader, also wants to make good on promises made. 2 weeks before the ruling, he issued a statement saying that Cherokee citizens must be equal under the law, regardless of descendancy, and have the right to hold public office. But not everyone is happy about this decision, and it's not because they don't support the Cherokee freedmen, although there is some anti-Black racism that exists in the Tribal Nation. Charlie Barnowski is a 32-year-old mother of three and a Cherokee citizen. She says leadership in the Cherokee Nation disrespected the process when they removed the words "by blood" from the Constitution.
The Constitution states that we as the people, we as the Cherokee people, are the ones that have the power to change the Constitution, whether that be by a vote of the people or by a constitutional convention.
Barnowski supports the freedmen, but she thinks what leadership did was illegal. Still, the ruling is a major civil rights win for the Tribal Nation, said University of Oklahoma law professor Taiyawagi Helton.
The court makes an incredibly powerful statement, rejecting a relic of a painful and ugly racial past that the court compares to Jim Crow laws in southern states.
The question that remains is whether or not leaders of the other four tribes who have treaty obligations to descendants of freedmen will look at this decision and grant citizenship to them. That's the Seminole Nation, the Choctaw Nation, Muscogee Creek Nation, and the Chickasaw Nation. For now, Van, who has always claimed and known her Cherokee heritage, says she's looking forward to running for a seat on the Tribal Council.
We'll just continue to try to outreach to the people and hope that sufficient people will believe that I've earned the right to represent them.
It's not clear whether there will be a challenge to last week's ruling, but for now at least, the Cherokee Nation is clear that it wants to move on from this painful part of their history. For The World, I'm Allison Herrera.
Here at The World, our virtual newsroom is abuzz, debating ideas to bring you important voices from around the world. Join the conversation and share our latest stories. You'll find us on Twitter. It's easy. We're at The World. Or hit me up. I'm at Marco Werman. Okay, leaving you today with this note about politics in France and marital loyalty. This week, former French President Nicolas Sarkozy became only the second president in that country's history to go on trial after serving office. Jacques Chirac did in 2011, also on corruption charges like Sarkozy, but Chirac was excused for health reasons. Nicolas Sarkozy was sentenced to 3 years in prison with the option of living at home with an ankle bracelet for the third year. He's appealing the verdict, which means for now he's at home with his wife, former supermodel and now singer Carla Bruni. After Sarkozy was sentenced on Monday, Carla Bruni posted to her Instagram a picture of her cuddling with the convicted ex-president, and this line, "What insane relentlessness, my love, at Nicolas Sarkozy. The fight continues, the truth will emerge, hashtag injustice." France's left-of-center newspapers offered the opposite conclusion. The headline in Libération yesterday, "Sarkozy convicted, justice for all." While her husband's case winds its way through the French appeals process, Carla Bruni's position was already carved out on a 2017 album, French Touch, where she covered several American pop songs, including this Tammy Wynette classic.
But if you love him, you forgive him. Even though he's hard to understand. If you love him, oh, be proud of him, 'cause after all, he's just a man. Stand by your man.
And so she does. Carla Bruni, the former French First Lady, singing a song that seems apt for her just-convicted husband, Nicolas Sarkozy. That's where we leave things today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Stand by your man and show the world you love him. Keep giving all the love you can.